life. So I'm going to be building upon what James has talked about. So he's talked about our modelling and how we've set up a new model for measuring cancer clusters, and I'm actually going to show you that applied to some real observations. Okay, so speed-dial calibrations, huge calibration. It got even bigger in 2005 when we started to CDI2. So we haven't heard a lot about this, but just to review, in case you've forgotten CDI, it's an interferometer, got 13 elements. It's on a 6 meter platform, which means it can have between 1 and 1.5 meter baselines. So by actually moving the antennas around, you can change the resolution of your observations. It operates 26 gigahertz. Well, polarization capability. So in CBI1, these 90 centimeter dishes had a field of view of 44 arcminutes, and it's sighted in Chile on the ALMA site. So we've already seen this many times before, but I really like this. And I think because CBI's been around for so long, it's actually in Google Earth. So we can zoom in on the site. And there we go. So here is the site itself. The containers around it have got the workshops, control rooms, toilets, bedrooms, and there's a dome that covers the telescope to protect it from the wind mainly. So the observing strategy, so the telescope itself is on a mount, it's a three-axis mount, rather than an elevation track specimen. It also rotates during the night, so we track parallactic angle. As I said, the antennas can be moved around, so long baselines and small angular scales, and short baselines to give you large angular scales. And as James says, in order to remove common main signals, such as ground pickup, we actually observe fields and strips, or as lead main trail combinations. Okay, so of course, CDI1, we've heard this many times, has done observations for small scale CMB. So, again, all the papers, all the results, excess detected. Between September 2002 and 2005, John also pointed this out again, it did do E-mode polarization. And again, got the force, there's 11 detection of the power spectrum in points combined. So you can see there to get the CBI being moved into its compact configuration in order to get the larger angular scales. During this time, CBI also did SZ observations. They did an initial sample of, I think, 15 low-gradient clusters selected from ROSAT, and a subsample of these 7 of these will be published in the results in 2004. So here's just a couple of images and results. But the main thing is, as James pointed out, is with CBI, what? Obviously, it was trying to detect the CMB, and on the largest scales, you actually get contamination of the SZ effect by CMB, so the structure here is CMB, and again, the visibility plots, the scatter is dominated by the CMB. So, well, I've said the limitations of CBI wasn't pretty unfair, really. I mean, CBI was pretty great. But if it did have any limitations, it was perhaps small dishes, but limited to filling factor at high L. So if you're trying to get to the largest, to the smallest angular scales at L of 2,500, where the excess is, ideally, you want to have long baselines and have the biggest dishes you can to keep the filling factor up. And it also applies for SZ, CMB contamination of clusters and short baseline. CMB contamination exceeds the thermal noise limit in short observations. So it was time for an upgrade. So in March 2005, CBI1 was turned off. It wasn't the end of the story for CDI. So there was still lots of place on the deck. This is it in its compact configuration. So the first thing to do is push all the antennas out to the edge of the table, get the longest baselines you can, and then find the size of antenna, the biggest you possibly can, that still just about fits on the table. So this is what we did. So this was the upgrade to this was essentially done in Oxford. What we did was we bought a load of essentially off-the-shelf 1.4 metre satellite images. They were pretty cheap. The service accuracy of these things is actually probably good to about 100 gigahertz. The only issue with them was they're actually kind of moulded and then have a ring put on them. And when the ring is put on, if it's not totally safe, that they get kind of Pringle-shaped. You do have Pringles in the US. So in order to compensate that, there's a secondary up here, which is on a phone cone. We actually machined all the secondaries for each of the 13 dishes exactly to compensate the error in the shape of the dishes. And that worked amazingly, amazingly well.
What do you say
they're achieving the world? It was like, what, 300 pounds each. And we bought 16 and we picked the best 13. So 1.4 metre dishes. We also took the opportunity to make the improve the optical design somewhat. So it's a new spillover, low spillover design. So the difference between these antennas and the previous ones on CBI is they don't have these cans around them. So in fact, we've under-illuminated the dishes such that when you actually look at the beams, this is a far out side lobe here. This red side lobe here is the CDI1 beam at 30 GHz. Low down here, you can see CDI2 now at 26 GHz and down at 36 GHz. So there's a much reduced side lobe level, which helps reduce the amount of ground we've got. In fact, with two more collecting area, and with the bigger dishes, we now have a resolution of 30 arc minutes. Okay, so it was a bit of a flat pack job. Oxford was quite away from Chile. So we packed everything up in crates, all the dishes and all the foam cones that supported the secondaries packed up. We then got a local farming shed in Chile. You can see all the farming equipment, unpacked our antennas and put them all back together. Hopefully, yes. So sorry, I called this the Blue Peter Guide to Essed Astronomy, and I guess Blue Peter is a bit of a British thing, but it's a children's program where they use sticky back paper, plastic, and glue to make pieces of things. And it kind of looks sticky, glue and sellotape. Sorry. So here you can see we've got foam cones. So the cone here, which supports the secondary, this is soap foam, and it's transparent at 30 GHz. So the kind of good thing about this design is there's no legs supporting the secondary, so there's no scattering at all. But you have to glue these cones together, again with special, really vile glue that again is transparent at 30 GHz. Press them into place, then lower the secondary into place and hold it in this kind of crazy clamp
for a day. We also realised that we needed some antenna covers, and again, because this was done on a shoestring, we couldn't afford Gore-Tex, and we found that actual tarpaulin material is a totally transparent at 30 GHz, so we made our own antenna covers. You can see Mike James and the engineers making their own circles. These were sewn up by a local Chilean lady who was quite impressed. She was helping out the telescope. Loaded them into the back of a lorry, and of course, the day we wanted to take them up at snow, but we went anyway.
Sorry,
tarpaulin, what is it made of?
It's woven poly and sheeting.
Yeah.
But it's the kind of stuff that you have on a building site coming over.
Yeah,
and
your sand or
something.
Okay, and then finally we had to get them on. I particularly like this picture because this,
how many metres high would you say that is there? Probably about 4 metres, and there's a plank across there, and these are fairly heavy.
Okay, so there's finally CBI-2 with its new 13 dishes. Right, so what did we do? So this is now, we've got to be about March 2006. So having got an improved telescope, we decided we'd try and have a go at doing some more deep CMB observations. The aim is to help confirm or otherwise the phone's excess power. And also to try and investigate whether if there was still excess power with these clusters. So we specifically selected different regions from the previous region we looked at with CBI, and we selected regions of sky with deep data at other wavelengths. In particular, we wanted to be able to cross-correlate later with deep optical infrared surveys, and also areas where there was already existing deep radio data, for example, VLA. So the three fields that we picked were the Cosmos field, the Subaru XM Newton deep survey field, and the Linos VLT deep field. Okay, so this is all very preliminary results.
We spent the last 2 years really just kind of getting out of data we could out of the telescope, and now we're just about to start putting all the data. So we observed in strips of four fields, so this was to improve the efficiency. On our Subaru XM deep field, we actually did the mosaic of 8 deep pointings, which was about 2 degrees in total, 2 square degrees. for the Veros and Cosmos fields, we only did 2 times 1 degree. The data's being analysed at the moment, and this is a very powerful breast map I made pushing the week. And initial analysis change is about 1 degree for the. So it's not quite as deep as some of the deepest, well, this in itself is not as deep as the deepest CBI patches that we've got already. But adding it with the rest of it, it's getting on for that, so it should hopefully make quite an improvement. Of course, we've already heard radio sources are a kind of big problem for these sort of observations. So we specifically chose regions this time which already had quite deep data in them to help solve this problem. In particular, in the SXDF field, there's very deep DLA data at 1.4 GHz. In fact, it's a complete catalog down to 100 microjanskis. So we've used, so partly to help with these specific fields and also the source problem in general, we've done follow-up at 30 GHz using ACCA. And we've looked at 250 of these sources that were selected at 100 microjanskis at 1.4, and looked at those for 30 GHz. 250 of them, we got 1.3 millijanskis RMS, and then we went deeper on a further 20 down to 300 microjanskis, and we didn't see anything. It made for a pretty boring observation program, but it was just noise. also, I mean, this. The question is, you know, if you look at MVSS sources, are you actually still missing quite a lot of the sources? So we also have done surveys of our fields at 5 and 8 GHz down to 600 microjanskis RMS to identify non-MVSS sources, which we can then follow up again at 30 GHz. So this is just an example of the SXDF region. Again, it's a preliminary analysis. We found about 25 sources in there, of which about 6 possibly don't have counterparts, but those need to be followed up. Well, these are not in MVSS. These 100 microjanskis ones. Yeah. No, we haven't done that yet. Okay, so that's a CMB, but the main thrust of really CBI2 was to get pointed SZ observations. So we want to use them to calibrate scaling relations, investigate evolution with redshift. Also, as James has pointed out, CBI2 probes clusters out to fairly large radii now, so we're looking out to 15 arc minutes radius, which enables us to look more at the global cluster physics and also hopefully get both the global properties and radial properties. In total, we've got about 40 pointed clusters. Some of the quick maps are shown there. So the X-ray samples we've looked at. So the first one is the ReXS sample. So this is an XNM sample. It's a flux-lifted sample of 33 X-ray clusters, and we've observed about thrice a third of them. We've got quite a range of luminosity, so this is quite a good one for scaling relations. And we're intending to do joint analysis of SZ and X-ray with XMM on this. The next sample is the Reflex DXL, again XMM selected, redshift 0.3. Not quite wider range of LX of luminosity, but this is a volume limited subset of the Reflex sample. We've observed all of these in green. The only one we couldn't see was one was at depth minus 77, which we couldn't see, and the other one just never got observed. The telescope died before we could do it. Okay, so then we've also looked at the SUSY sample. So these are all the clusters that we looked at with SUSY at 150, 220, 270, 350. So in collaboration with Sarah Church, we want to have a go at actually combining our low-frequency data with the higher-frequency stuff in order to try and get a lever arm on the spectra. And finally, we had a sample at redshift 0.5, which was really to try and see if we could get scaling relations as a function of redshift. Again, this is a complete X-ray flux-limited sample of the bright distance clusters. Obviously, these are very bright. We also did a kind of few crazy things with both CBI1 and CBI2. So one thing was to have a go at looking at the Shapley supercluster. So we've already heard that Dick's is quite an interesting thing to totally impossible. Well, we tried it. So this is actually the CBI1 map, the Shepherd Sea Cluster. It's not all the data, we've got at least twice as much data from CBI2. It's not been cleaned, and the sources, I think one source has been removed. So this is the X-ray map. So you can see at least that we've, so this is inverted, so YT is negative decrements. So at least there is some peak correlation there with X-ray clusters. The idea is to see if we have any hope of seeing intercluster filaments. We've also looked at a few high redshift candidates, and also this thing, TDF-1435, which is a possible lens to quasar pair, which someone thought it might be quite interesting to look at. And the data on that is quite weird. There's something there, but we're not quite sure what it is. So with all of this data, all the clusters that are in common to both CBI1 and CBI2, we want to combine the data together, because that will give us a large range of baselines. Okay, so we've started the analysis of the 11 clusters from Reflex DXL. These are some of the maps here that are together. So these are long baseline maps. So this is the low resolution maps, and hopefully you see decrements in most of these. Actually, this is quite interesting, you'll see in a minute. And if you can see the contours, those are sigma contours, is that right?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, so the bullet's obviously hugely bright. One sigma. Yeah, and they're different. There's different thermal noise in each one because they were observed at different lengths. Not CMB. Okay, but can you see that at all? As James said, we don't actually do the analysis of the maps, we do the visibilities. So I think you can see this at all. So there's the bullet, for example. As much as the baseline, you've got a negative decrement going up. So that R 332 looked like there was nothing in the map, but actually, when you azimuth the average order of visibilities, you can actually see there is actually an indication there is a decrement there. So it's probably worth putting through our analysis to see what goes on. Right, so radio source identification. Again, clusters radio sources for the 30 gigahertz is still a problem. Because we do this lead main trail strategy, so with a lead field, then a main cluster field, and then a trailing field, and we subtract the lead and the trail from the main, we actually end up with both positive and negative radio sources in our field. So we need to actually find out all the sources in all three of these fields, each cluster. So again, with using APCA, we've looked at, we went slightly overboard, but we looked at all the NDSS or surface sources in all of our cluster fields. So this is an example, this is within the field of view of our CBI. Can anyone see this? I can't see it. No.
Yeah.
okay, so, well, as I said again, positive sources in the main field are crosses, plus signs, crosses, negative sources, and then the ones which are actually being highlighted, so here, there's one there, and there, are ones we actually detect with ACPA 30 gigahertz. In addition, we've also done mosaics of the field centres of all fields at 8 and 4 GHz, again to check if there's any non-NVSS sources that we missed. Okay, right, so now to try and put some of James's stuff into practice, we've taken one of our clusters, so the bullet, I think it's the most popular and widest. We've got a big detector of it. So as we said, CBI sends tip-off scales at R200, which is about, well, 2R200 is about 80 knot minutes. And we use our data in conjunction with the SA, the X-ray service brightness data, to try and recover some of the global and radial properties using James's model. So I thought it's quite interesting just to point out, so here's the CBI observation, and the scale of the cluster in our observation is right in the centre. So you can see that we really are detecting far out. Okay, so this bullet map is a source of traction. We actually detected quite a few sources in the bullet. I was trying to get the map with the 8 gigahertz, so all data from Oxford today, but failed with the FTB. And again, visibility. So you can see we're actually detecting flux write out very long baselines on this. I should say, this is a long baseline map, this full resolution map, and the deck sets is still the SZ. So.
Okay. Can you actually see these plots?
Right, this is all very, very preliminary. So this is actually essentially pulling real data to the timeline that James described for the first time. So pulling the X-ray surface brightness plots from the Changtel papers and run through the whole model fitting. So these are the fitted quantities to the data. So this is the recovery of the X-ray surface brightness, the recovery of the SZ. These are preliminary. This is because there's a known problem which is giving us ripples in our recovery capabilities. So that's a feature that has now been fixed. Curve X temperature and
density. Okay, and so these are the derived cluster properties, radial profiles.
So what's the gap? So pressure profile, entropy, temperature. So we're actually getting a nice temperature profile on the lens. I should say these are all plotted out to 1.5 megapascals, our 500. So we can compare directly with the Changtel results. Again, F-gas, we can see a nice increase in F-gas as we go out to the large radii. And again, total max.
Here it appears to be. F-gas, well, yeah, I mean, that's the fit to the... But this is to real, I mean, this is real, this is the fit to the bullet, yeah.
Okay, so now these are the global properties that we've derived from our bullet plots. Again, and ultimately, this is the first time that we actually tried to send it through, and although we're pretty confident. So again, total mass, so we're getting a total mass of the bullet. Again, our 500 is about 1.2 D. So the dotted line here and error bars is the result from the JAMA paper for X-ray, so that was their mass. F-gas, again, it's quite a good fit there. And I think this one's quite interesting. So this is the temperature. So there we haven't put any spectral, X-ray spectra. Spectra in. This is purely from X-ray surface brightness and XZ, and we're constraining the temperature fairly well there. And we talked about this earlier, but we're at the lower end of the temperature range for bullets. It's about 12 kV. Okay, this slide was meant to be small. I didn't realise the screen was going to be so big, but scaling relations, yes, we are going to be scaling relations. don't be particularly anything into this. We are starting to plot them. These are actually all run through with beta models. And obviously with our samples, we can do this fairly easily now. So finally, that's CBI2. We've got these 40 clusters in hand, operating from 2006 to 2008, when we finally shut down and taken apart. We've got deep CMB data in hand, which we hope will improve upon the CBI data that's already there. We've got a large sample of SZ pointing clusters out to large radii. We've got a new model that we want to try and extract both global and radial properties from these clusters, combined with X-ray. And we will use our samples to better constrain scaling relations. So CBI2 is now sat in a container at the top of the Andes. Anyone wanting to put it back together is welcome to talk to us. And that's the end. Ones, do you wanna... Is it what, sorry? Do you know it? They're all coming out about 1, aren't they? 1.1. should go.
Yes.
Okay, so this is only plotted out to half. The only integrated, so it's integrated out. I think it's partly surprising that it's worked at all, given that it's potentially such a mess. So.
Well, you get something. The question is, do you keep it going on?
So, well, which one costs you done? 5 to 2.
Yeah.
And another defect on it. Definitely.
Yeah.
Relax, is that it?
So you did this analysis. I mean, the question is, if you do this with simulation, something that looks like a little faster, you get. How much harder is it to make up mass, for example?
But it's interesting, so that FPP one kind of has a merger.
One
of those simulations.
Not that far.
Yeah. I mean, where's the, you know, we get set. At the moment, for the X-ray stuff, we're actually using published results. So obviously, the benefit is to do a joint fit of the actual X-ray and said data, rather than taking their fit to their
Oops, sorry. Oops, sorry.
one interesting thing in that amount of paper, they say something about this John et al. Published two different papers on it, and in that time, the calibration, the SMM center calibration had changed the temperature that they got, depended on which X-ray they had to use. They went from 212 kPa or 0.5 kPa. And they say in 2006 or 2007 paper that for all their clusters, it didn't matter which temperature band they used, except for the bullet.
Thank you.